What's up, everybody? This is Carrick with ACG, and welcome to a Stranger Things 3 season podcast. Why are we talking about it? Especially me, as I usually handle video games. Well, if you ever watch the podcast, you certainly know I like to cover TV shows as well. But there's a lot about Stranger Things, in particular season 3, that I think really shows the excellence that can be had in episodic storytelling. But additionally, there's a lot of parallels there between video game creation when it comes to episodic format and TV show creation and how those things are done. So I want to talk about those things and, of course, just talk about season 3 in particular and go through it. Now, you might be wondering exactly how you should listen to this. You can certainly listen to it as you're just sitting down, driving, and all the way through, or you could bring up the show itself. I'll be breaking it down, usually cut by cut. I probably missed a couple different cuts as I went through some of my notes. I apologize for that. But I'm going to talk about each episode in particular and then talk about them as a more collective whole, dive into some of the things I think and how well it does some of the different portrayals of different times that we have in the United States, especially 1980s, 1990s. And then another thing is discuss how some of those excellent portrayals could be reflected in video games. So without further ado, Stranger Things Season 3 podcast beginning right now. One of the things I want to say is I haven't really decided how I'm going to split this up. So it could be just two episodes where I cover a couple episodes of the show per large podcast, or I do them all as one. It'll just sort of depend on what I want to talk about. When it comes to Stranger Things 3, the one thing to remember is this, of course, being the third season, you really have to look at what they've done with the characters, especially when season one, when you have this group of kids together and you decide to introduce a big baddie, you decide to introduce your overall plot theme. And this is something that we see in role playing and Dungeons and Dragons. We see in video games, we see in major movies and novels and TV shows. When you introduce those big baddies, how do you put everybody at risk? And really what they did with the first season was they introduced innocence as being the thing that was at risk, this invasion that occurred. Season two somewhat reflected the same thing, but you also noticed what I would consider a more strengthening of the group in season two. And I think when we look back on it later, if there's a season four, or even if it just for whatever reason stopped at season three, a lot of people may consider season two a little bit iffy when it comes to the way things were portrayed. And I believe I can explain some of that. I'll certainly want to talk about it as I go through in the podcast. There are so many people in this show that I want to just sort of read the different actors real quick. You have Winona Ryder as Joyce Byers. You have David Harbour as Jim Hopper. You have Finn Wolfhard as Mike Wheeler. Millie Bobby Brown as Eleven. Gaten Matsurazu, I'm totally pronouncing that wrong completely, as Dustin Henderson. Caleb McLaughlin as Lucas Sinclair, Natalie Dreyer as Nancy Wheeler, Charlie Heaton as Jonathan Byers, Cara Buono as Karen Wheeler, Matthew Modine as Martin Brenner, Noah Schnapp as Will Byers, Sadie Sink as Maxine or Max Mayfield, Joe Keery as Steve Harrington, Dakir Montgomery as Billy Hargrove, Sean Austin as Bob, Paul Reiser as Sam Owens, Maya Hawke as Robin, and Brett Gelman as Murray. Now, again, I probably did mess a couple of those up. You also have Alexia, who we're going to talk about in a little bit. He is a Russian scientist in the show, and I don't know the actor's name as I start this podcast, so I apologize for that. I just wanted to sort of give you guys the names of those different people, because occasionally I'm going to be talking about them separately, the actor or the character that they portray, depending on what part of the story I'm trying to explain. One of the elements that I was talking to Sleeve, who's in the patron Discord, about Stranger Things is you certainly do notice a lot of reflections of movies. This is something that we see in video games, whether they directly crib the IP, as we've seen with The Walking Dead, or they just take different elements of an overarching IP and put them in their games, such as Alan Wake and Stephen King. When it comes to Stranger Things, especially that first season and second season, you can certainly see that the Duffer Brothers crib different movies. And in the third season, I think it's even more noticeable that what you have is a mixture of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and you certainly have a lot of references to The Blob, which was a really ancient black and white, very scary movie when it came out and has been remade a couple times overall. And you have a lot of different elements from both of those, including some different elements in the background that you'll see graphically represented, whether it be posters and so forth. We also see a lot of reflections of License to Drive, the 1980s kind of teen coming to grips with their age moments that we get in a lot of TV shows. But the Duffer Brothers have really been able to get away with something just simply because of when they framed the time frame for the show, which is that they could put direct references to a lot of those things in there. And we see a lot of those, and it does a great job solidifying the moment, which I will definitely get to. The first thing I want to discuss is the starting of season one. Season one really shows that Russian influence right away. It shows the foreign military power. It does a good job solidifying a bad guy quite quickly, or at least another group of bad guys. This is something that season one and two tried to do to various degrees, I think, of success. Season three, regardless of what you think of the Russians and the military and the later stuff that we'll cover in the other episodes, I personally believe it was a fairly good introduction. It was an introduction to the way things were going to be and the way the Russians were going to treat things versus the United States. The United States military in the prior episodes and prior seasons was more that typical Department of Energy, the typical CIA kind of stuff where it was all behind the scenes. What goes on in the Russian moment is it opens up and it introduces them. Yes, they are humans, but it obviously shows that they're going farther and faster than the United States government ever tried right away. They're using a gate. They're keying it up. They're trying to break open the membrane to the upside down pretty much right away. And they're failing multiple times. You can tell this is not the first time they've attempted to. And they're trying multiple times to just ramrod their way through. This is something that we weren't quite sure exactly how the United States government did it or exactly what they did. But theirs was obviously connected to 11 and psychic powers with the ability to move through the membrane. What happens with the Russians is once again, you have that overarching militant style of we're just going to key up a giant fucking laser gun. We're going to shoot it at some rocks and we're going to see if we can open up this membrane. They do try and they do fail. Again, you get the idea that they've failed a couple times. But when it does open, they get a little bit of that darkness coming out from the upside down. So it's obvious that they know where they're going. They know what they're trying to do. They just can't successfully do it. We find out pretty much right away how the Russians are going to treat things because they kill the major scientist right at the starting who fails this project, giving Alexia, the secondary scientist, 1 year for success after that. So you get this idea of exactly what's going on. We're also introduced almost right away to what I call the T-500. I don't know what you call him, but the Russian super spy that ends up having a lot of references to Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator 1 and 2. And we see him quite a bit in this show. He, of course, killing that major scientist. As you can tell, I like this introduction. I've always been a fan, whether it be movies, TV shows, whether it be role-playing games, of introducing in a small snippet those bad guys. It works quite well. It sort of punches at home and it gives you an idea in a very quick amount of time exactly what they're about by just doing a couple actions. We see that overly militant style of doing things with just shooting a gun at a wall. We see the various safety precautions they have in place, which are a bit of foreshadowing for the last episode. And you see the way the spy and the way the major Russian commander deals with failure, which is just killing the people who have all the knowledge, which is something that you guys have heard me talk about when it comes to game layoffs, when it comes to all kinds of game development, where I'm always really bothered whenever, you know, you see a major scientist die due to failure or something like that. Because you're like, listen, this guy's got all the knowledge in the world and he can't succeed, which is one thing. But would you really just kill him? Just put somebody else above him, keep him there for his knowledge. But instead, they take that repository of knowledge and they smash it. And that's something that we see in our own history, but it's also something that we see in a lot of video games, where you see that overarching power command come up and you see all that knowledge that is disappointingly destroyed and that ends up causing issues later, which, boom, it will in this show. Very good opening. I really did enjoy it. I think it set the tone perfectly for how the Russians were going to deal with things. Now, the second cut is it moves off and it shows Mikey and Eleven kissing and his bad singing. This is really well done. It shows not only the way they are when they're together, even though they're with Hopper, they're at that at the cabin out in the woods, but you get to see Mikey's terrible singing and the way things are done and the way that Eleven has overall, I would say, sort of slid into the at least somewhat normal childhood situations that any kids of that age would end up going into. One of the things the Duffer Brothers do right away, though, is they show you that she is not as normal as everybody else, because just a couple seconds later, you see Hopper looking in. She notices he starts yelling and she uses her powers to close the door. One of the things I noticed while watching this show that I wanted to ask you guys about is I noticed that Hopper was really back to his slovenly self. I think that the Duffer Brothers have done a good job with Hopper in particular. And in fact, I would have to say that if we all sat down and argued about this, I would have a very difficult time not believing that Hopper really is the main character above Eleven, the feeling of a failed parent who's then gone on to try again and have those attempts again, and also show that just because you've had those attempts at first, lost a child, come back, doesn't mean you're going to be incredibly good at it. We get to see Hopper in a way that I don't think we saw him in the other seasons, other than season one, where he was sort of a mess. We saw in season two, at the end of season one, he was sort of picking things up. And then in season three, he's sitting there eating salsa and nachos. There's chips all over his face. He's definitely gained weight. I don't know if that was on purpose, but I liked that reflection of him as a person who possibly, if he doesn't have a great goal in mind, is a person who falls apart. This is something that I think makes some of the most interesting characters in the world. Characters where if they don't have something going on, if they don't have a step, one, two, three, if they don't have a goal in mind, they cannot keep themselves constructed as a person. And you start to see them fall apart. This is something that I think for most people, they need some goals. But for some people in particular, and I think very much so Hopper, especially when you look at what he is doing with his life, being a sheriff and so forth, if he doesn't have something that he's investigating or driving forward, he's not very good at it. And something as nebulous as being a good parent isn't really fulfilling that void. He's trying, but it's not really working, and he doesn't know exactly how to do it. So, as we'll see later in the episodes, he ends up talking to Joyce, Winona Ryder's character, to try to figure out ways around this, because she's the only one who, as a single mother, though her kids aren't the best, she's somewhat at least got them to move forward through life. The Duffer Brothers continue to use some music I think is excellent here. They also do some foreshadowing with Eleven's music player that's in the room. But this is a really good time. It's very short. It just so again shows Mikey and Eleven kissing and has a good overall joke when Hopper tries to run in the room and she uses the power to close the door. This closure is a really good part of the episode. I think when you start to see this, you'll certainly see it as you watch the different episodes of the TV show itself. They do a really good job with cuts from moment to cut from one scene to the next. In fact, I think that they've really stepped it up a level that didn't really occur in seasons one and two, where you see some really good graphical stylings when it comes to cuts between different elements in the show, which I'll definitely talk about. Now, it does cut. It goes to Will and the others go into the movie as they sit down the movie. The power goes out. This is all of them sort of getting together. They sit down, the power goes out, and this isn't really explained why it is. It goes out all over the city, and you see different characters trying to get the power on everywhere. You even see Steve and, just for a second, Robin, as they're in their ice cream shop, and Steve's trying to just flick the lights on, doing really the Steve kind of thing, which is the brute force kind of way. And in fact, Steve and the Russians have a lot of different differences, but a lot of similarities in the show, which I'll get to, at least in how they do things. From that quick cut, it ends up going over to the Brimborn Steelworks, and there's either something coming up from the ground, it's a gravity anomaly of some sorts, or something waking up and a sort of a sound or a power effect occurring at the same time. This only happens for just a small amount of time, and then the power comes back on. You've got Lucas and Max and everybody sitting in the movie theater, and you notice that Will ends up reaching towards his neck, and he feels the sense of the upside down or the sense of the darkness coming out again. I will certainly say that what I think marred all of the episodes in season three, and this is something you'll hear me talk about in video games, you hear me talking about it in movies, in board games, D&D, what have you, when information is really not passed along for no reason other than to add drama. Season three, if there is an issue with the season, it is absolutely that. This is a what you would term as a magical power that Will has, which is the ability to sense this. And he continues through season two a little bit to not tell people. And then season three pops up, and multiple times, multiple different characters have the ability to just come together and talk for a couple seconds. And these are not the characters I'm saying that are fighting, by the way. These are characters that are friendly with each other, because you do have some teen angst going on in that group. And they don't talk. And that's actually a big deal. It was very bothersome to me to have Will notice that and not warn people right away, especially because after season one, he had the issue at the end of season one, season two. all of these things happen, and you could play it off as Will being in fear, Will not wanting to tell his friends, Will being fearful himself of what's going on and wanting everything to be normal. This is certainly replicated in the later episodes where we see Will fighting everybody else to keep the normalcy of life. So I get that, but it's also something that a lot of other characters do as well, which I don't like. So then the next morning starts up, and you have a cut to Nancy and Jonathan sleeping over at Joyce's home. They're in bed together. They're waking up late. Nancy's late for work, or you think she's the only one late for work. You find out that Jonathan and Nancy both work together at the newspaper, with Nancy being pretty much a glorified secretary and Jonathan running the dark room there. This is a really cool segue. I think, in fact, it would have been a cooler cut if it had come right after cutting from Mikey and Eleven kissing, because you get this feeling, like I said, later on that Hopper continues to go to Joyce for advice. But then when it cuts to this part, Joyce is just letting them fuck in the bedroom that's right next to them with no big deal. So no one's perfect in this show, obviously. Nancy and Jonathan get up. And they leave, and they're driving together to work, and it's a fairly harsh argument. It's an argument that I think a lot of different couples will have with each other. It's an argument that isn't necessarily surprising to see two people have, but you can already sort of see a rift there, with Jonathan still definitely wanting to side with Nancy, but at the same time, not really feeling the things that Nancy feels. You know, whether you believe at this time this would have been realistic, I think this is a very realistic argument for the time, but I also believe that Nancy in particular sort of came into her own in season two, and she absolutely does in season three. It's ridiculous. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Nancy, the Nancy name works perfectly, because they even tease her in the newsroom about being Nancy Drew. She absolutely is. She does a great job, and her argument with Jonathan makes a lot of sense, with Jonathan sort of wanting that status quo to continue, and additionally just not understanding where she's coming from. It pretty quickly moves on from there, and it goes to Dustin coming back. I love Dustin. I love the actor. I love his character in the shows. I've always felt that he was one of those great characters that I think really does reflect a lot of kids' feelings of being awkward, but at the same time, you know, still trying to have a little bit of an attitude at the time. And it breaks through that he's having some issues here, especially in this particular episode, because he comes back and he can't get anybody on his radio. This is, once again, a really good reflection of things that have changed. This is something that we see in The Walking Dead, but, you know, when you look at The Walking Dead, the things that have changed is the there were no zombies and then there suddenly are. You get that with a lot of video games, because they want to introduce you to the action and they don't have that time to sort of solidify this moment in time, this narrative moment, and give you a feeling of something slowly occurring. But you have something like this, which is 8, 9, 10 episodes, depending on what TV show you're talking about. They have a lot more time to develop this. They do a good job. Dustin's in the car. He drops a Star Wars reference, a very good Star Wars reference. And it also foreshadows the radio issues that they're going to be having with a lot of the different military establishments blocking communications in their small town. He does end up having an issue. He can't get a hold of them. You're not 100% sure if he can't because of that or because they don't want to show up. When it comes to shows this big, I think they do a pretty good job introducing everybody almost right away and in their element that they're going to be in, not only as a character and as a teen at that time, but also in the world itself, what they're fighting for. Because really this show is, especially this season, is a big fight for normalcy versus what's actually occurring. People really not wanting to adjust that status quo, but at the same time, obviously understanding the world's changing. And then additionally to that, understanding that the world outside them is trying to once again cause issues, and that battle of everybody coming together and saying, you know what, we have all these issues, let's come together and still solve this. So I think the foreshadowing that Dustin has, it's really well done. You get to reintroduce to his mother. There's some cool ways in which his mom sort of tries to tell him, hey, you just need to calm down and let things sort of happen the way they should happen. And Dustin's attitude at that time really shows the frustration that he feels as a friend coming back from a summer vacation kind of moment. Everybody else got to stay in town. He went away and he came back. And you never really quite get the idea if he did this on purpose or if his parents pushed him to do this or what. But there's definitely that feeling of everybody else having been together for most of the summer with Dustin being out and not around. So then we have the big cut, and this is where you jump into your reintroduction to Billy, Max's brother. Billy, I think, as a character, he came up, we didn't really know exactly what was going on with this character, especially in season two. I mean, you know what he is. He's the jack off of all trades. He's the guy that sort of replaces Steve as the popular kid in school. He shows up. You notice that there was some chemistry there with Karen, who's Nancy's mom, in season two, but it never really goes anywhere other than some weird looks. And this is certainly a reverse of Fast Times, a Ridgemont High kind of moment when you end up getting Billy introduced at the swimming pool. He's a lifeguard now. He's working with another character. And it's great because you have this really cool dichotomy the Duffer brothers put in. You have the female, really hot. She's basically sitting up there in the tower watching kids. And you think for a moment, it's going to be that thing where she gets down and walks around and everybody's staring at her. But instead, it cuts to the mothers. It cuts to Karen sitting with some of the other parents of different kids in school. And they're all bitching about this girl. They're like, I hate her voice. I hate whenever she talks. I hate all this kind of stuff. And then they're counting down to when Billy is going to come out and take over the job as the lifeguard. I think this is an incredible sort of flip that they did. And it definitely, if you're somebody who's seen Fast Times at Ridgemont High, you've seen Phoebe Cates get out of the water, you've seen, the masturbatory scene, all that kind of stuff. This is sort of turned on its head and I think was just really well done. So Billy comes out and ends up walking by saying he notices Karen has changed her swimsuit. This is something that it's just a little bit on Billy's side to sort of make sure that Karen knows that he's watching her. And there's a bit of sexual tension there. You can certainly see Nancy's mom is jonesing a little bit. And you're trying to figure out exactly where that sort of strange relationship would end up going, especially because Billy is definitely in high school. You also get the idea, of course, that this is Nancy's mom and Nancy is involved in all this kind of strange stuff. So how's everything going to work out? I think it's done incredibly well. Once again, really good job on flipping that narrative and really good job on the music and the colors. And once again, these guys really nail with their costumes, the one piece swimsuits, the makeup that Karen's mom has is just a little thicker or maybe much thicker than we see now, obviously with the different colors of the time period. But you see this mother situation and that reversal is just incredibly well done. So what it does next is it cuts to Hopper bitching to Joyce about Mikey and Eleven. And you can see he's insanely prudish. This is something that you start to figure out once again is something that really does show that Hopper, that control factor 5 that this guy's got. He wants that ultimate amount of control. Joyce is more open to that relationship. She's more open to understanding where Eleven and Mikey might be. But she also, once again, as I said before, she's got Nancy and Jonathan fucking in her spare bedroom. In Jonathan's bedroom. So it's not like she's absolutely against this kind of stuff happening. This is all also done to a backdrop of something that I found really interesting. It's a great deal of foreshadowing. It's certainly something that we do see in some games, but once again, we see this is why I do fight for the ability, at least for companies, to go with some kind of episodic video game series because you have this slow build. But if you notice, Joyce is talking to him, and while she's doing it, she's putting up this backdrop of everything being on sale in the store. This is something that we will find out not only really, I think, reflects the economics of the time, because we know the economics of that time in particular, but also what's going on in the world itself. This is something that the Duffer brothers, I think, did a good job on mimicking and really reflecting the different economics, and also somehow working that into the narrative and working it into the narrative heavily. It's obvious that they did a lot of research and they made sure this all works out. So she's putting up, it really reminds you of, let's say, a Payless. If you know those stores, if you're from America, you'll know them. There's probably an equivalent pretty much wherever you live. But whenever a Walmart would move in, the Fred Meyers, the Paylesses would start to lose their money. Whenever a new mall came in, the Paylesses or the smaller stores would lose their money. And you'd see them starting to put these crazy sales on 50, 70, 80%. This is also a very cool reflection of what's changed, because if you guys remember in season 1 and 2, especially in season 1, Joyce asks her boss for some kind of money loan because she needs to borrow money, and the store is filled up with people. There's a boss there. There's coworkers. What you see here, no one's there. Joyce is all by herself, and everything in the store, this is called facing. If you've ever been worked at retail, you face the store. What that means is you walk around the store and you take any of the items and you face them forward so that people can see them when they come in. And if you have a small amount of items, you space and face. So you take them, you face them forward so people can see, but you also space them out so that it makes the shelves feel busier. Because if a shelf feels empty, people will actually psychologically think, oh, people aren't buying the stuff here. It's just the way sales work. This is something you see Joyce doing throughout this entire moment. Very, very well done. Also, as Hopper is talking to Joyce, you notice that Hopper, he's always been, he does pick up on things. He certainly is a very astute kind of character. He's somebody who has a high investigation rating, you would say, if you were playing Dungeons and Dragons with him and you had a score for that. But he also doesn't necessarily do that whenever anything about his own personal life, and especially 11, ends up coming up. Now, this is, of course, a reflection of what's happened in his past, and his focus is 100% soul focus on 11, and his focus on the fact that the unknown is what caused 11 to be hurt in the first place, the unknown of what happened originally in his past, and that desire to remove that from life. And he just doesn't notice what is going on with Joyce or what she's doing or even the problems she's having this entire time. This is a cumbersomeness that is reflected multiple times in the way they discuss things and the way they talk. There's a short moment here where it goes over and it shows Nancy at the newspaper. Nancy goes into work. She's buying everyone food, putting it down. You have Gary Busey's son. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but you have him as the typical jackass, the male chauvinist pig kind of thing. But you know, that was at that time frame, it probably wasn't as unknown or at least as little seen as it is now. And those characters sort of reacting a particular way to Nancy. One of the things I do like is the main editor of the newspaper or the owner of the newspaper. You can't really get an exact idea of what he's thinking. And the Duffer brothers did something intelligent here because this plays out later in the episodes. They don't show his reactions to a lot of what's going on in those moments. They show little ones, but they don't show a bunch. And in fact, in some of the camera scenes, he's not in the picture when you see other characters in the newsroom really reacting to Nancy. And there's a reason for this, which we'll get to it a little bit later. But again, masterful performance on their part. And I think we see this in a lot of games where you'll see that moment where a character says something and there's the flash of recognition on somebody's face and that really ruins it for later. You're like, no, that guy's this or this guy's this or this guy, you know, wants to side with the good character, that kind of stuff. And because, once again, you have an episodic format here, you can stretch this out. This is one of the reasons why I really do believe that a Stranger Things styled episodic game would work really well. I do like this kind of format, especially when it comes to TV shows, but this also reflects, it reflects role-playing as well, where you have a role-playing game where you have different scenes and you have people sit down and they play these out and there's more time to develop. It's one of the reasons why, especially when it comes to particular role-playing games, a lot of people like some of the softer skills they're called in a role-playing game, some of the skills that necessarily don't seem like they'd be useful. They're not an attack skill, right? They're not a punching skill. They're a knowledge about arcane things or a knowledge about, you know, history books or something like that, where you think it really doesn't pay off, but it does. And in fact, we get to see that here later on when Joyce ends up meeting the math teacher and talking to him, where you have a character who's got no real skills of use, who's actually shown up a couple times in each season showing those skills of use, those softer skills. That's what's so great about the show, and I think what reflects so nicely here. So Nancy ends up mentioning, as she's leaving the newsroom, she's talking to all these people, and she mentions Starcourt the Mall. Now, this is the first time this is mentioned. The main mall is mentioned as being a big news story, and this is where you get a reflection back to what Joyce was doing. You start to find out Nancy really mentions that the mall has ended up taking a bunch of jobs. It's ended up taking a bunch of businesses off the main street and moving them. And once she says this, you now get the idea that not only is it the overall economic times that this was filmed in, but that this mall in particular, the introduction of this mall has changed the economics of the town in a particular way. And I like that. No one listens to her, of course. They talk about Nancy Drew and they kick her out. There's a lot of sex jokes kind of thing as she leaves. But I really like that it's just momentary and it's something that allows for it to sit for a second. And if you're paying attention, you'll reflect back on what Joyce was doing. And if you don't, they go back to it enough times that you pick up on it. So from there, it goes to Max and Lucas and then to Dustin, really showing everyone his tech at his home. They surprise him for his birthday. This includes a ham radio, and he randomly mentions his girlfriend, Susie. I liked this because Dustin mentions his girlfriend in a way that makes you question if she's real, but at the same time, his confidence makes you guess that she probably is. But there is this question there. And I love that kind of narrative. I love it in games. I love it in movies, TV shows, that questionable narrative where it's a soft admission of something. And what that does is it offers just a little bit of suspicion on everybody's part. Also, everybody knows, you know, Dustin admits it quite easily in the show, and especially in this season, that he's got a disease, and that disease, you know, makes him so he doesn't grow in his teeth, you know, various different things. He's sort of he considers himself a little bit goofier looking. So you don't get the idea. You don't really know what's going on. But you also get the idea of change occurring regardless of what's in the town. This is something that they do a great job in the show, where they give you the indication that the town is not just, it's the center of this situation, but not the center of the world. Other things are occurring. And that's reflected in TV shows. It's reflected in stuff that's on the radio. And once again, it's reflected here with Dustin talking about his girlfriend. I really like that. It's just momentary. And they end up deciding that they're going to go off and they're going to put up this ham radio so he can talk to Susie. And there's some elements of that that we end up getting to, which I really liked. You also get one of the first real interactions between Max and Lucas, which I'm going to be pretty open that I feel that Max, the character is really poorly written in this season. In fact, I think it's one of the most poorly written characters in all three seasons, which I'll get to. Certainly has nothing to do with the actress, but there was a lot that was going on in the show that it just, especially when you look at these kind of shows reflecting teens and stuff like this, certainly is a character that would probably exist in that group, but might end up finding themselves on the way out quite quickly, especially with all of the havoc that character causes. And I just wasn't in love with the way everything went together when it came to Max and Lucas. And really, to me, lands with a dud compared to all the other characters. So still in the same episode, it now moves to Steve. And I got to say, I love Steve. Steve cracks me up. Steve has had such growth from season 1 to 2 to 3. This is, once again, something I love to see when you see video games, when you see the growth of characters, even in a Gears of War, which, yeah, may sound weird, but you do see some growth in those characters. You see some growth in Nathan in Uncharted. You see this awesome growth of these characters, especially Uncharted 4, where you see Nathan go into the old lady's home, who is a hoarder, basically, and an adventurer. And you get this idea that this is exactly what is awaiting Nathan if he continues. And is also a great reflection of Nathan's own attic at the starting, when you start to notice he's starting to collect stuff. And there's that warning, that subtle warning that's occurring that makes you realize what could happen. Steve is the really popular kid who doesn't know what to do with himself. And we see that a lot of times, where the popular kid has one sort of pillar of the support system taken away and doesn't really have any skills on how to put it together. But you also see he's got a very good heart. And we certainly do see this as we move forward. Steve's dressed in his Navy suit. This is one of the worst uniforms I've ever seen. I don't know if this is a real ice cream shop, but he's dressed as like the Pillsbury Doughboy. They do everything they can to remove the one thing about Steve, which was his looks, his hair. Everything about him just looks obviously a little bit askew, and I think that was handled masterfully. It shows that the growth of the character when it comes to just age and experience and what he's encountering, but also in the fact that people's statuses in life change. And Steve's, I would say, on the downslope of an excellent life, and he's heading into a place where he doesn't quite know exactly what's going on. This is reflected by Robin, who is Ethan and Uma Thurman, Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman's daughter, Robin. And she's counting his failures on hitting on girls on a whiteboard in the background. This is, once again, a really good quick indicator. These are all quick indicators of where every character is. Also, that all by itself, other than the one moment we see Robin, I should have mentioned this, she was just briefly shown for a second when the power went out, but it shows Robin and what she's like right away. She's not mean to Steve. She just teases him, and she's counting his failures, and then she's the one who points out new girls are coming into the store when Steve is talking to her. She's the one that points out that a new group of girls are coming in and he should try again. And there's this strange, goofy camaraderie that is almost instantly proven in that section. And this is something that we see in games a lot of times, where you get these odd intersects of characters where you certainly can tell that Robin, the way she looks, the way she acts, she probably, and we find this out later, isn't really the most popular. Steve is. You see that dichotomy there. But we see it if you even look at Alan Wake, where Barry shows up and Barry's his agent. And the weirdness and oddity and uncomfortable and just the way that character is versus Alan Wake and the way he is. We see it in other games as well, where you have that one-off character. But Robin's handled, I think, really subtly. They do a really good job. And once again, we see that the length of an episodic format can really help. Robin, once again, she points him out to the next ladies, and he goes, and he stunningly fails. And he does it so well. Steve turns around, and for reasons that I just have to say are so well done, the Duffer Brothers had him record him yelling, "Ahoy," because he is dressed like a sailor. But he turns around, and it's that moment when you realize somebody's slightly uncomfortable, and so their voice does something they're not expecting, and his "ahoy" is like 2 decibels, maybe 5 decibels too loud. It's a great scene. Also, before I move on, I got to mention that Robin counting his failures is a very good precursor to sort of what some of Robin's skills are. She is very analytical. This is something that we see. And her style of joking is not only verbal, which we see in a lot of characters, but something as simple as her counting his failures indicates a watchfulness that is actually reflected later in Robin and the way she acts. So very cool again. Now, this cuts to Hopper. He's going over the main speech that he wants to give his daughter, and he returns again. This is something we see a lot of times, where Hopper is obviously getting a lot of advice from Joyce about how to raise kids, but you get the idea as well. He's not just doing it just for that. He's going over the main speech of the show. He also indicates that he wants to take Joyce out, and Joyce sort of plays it off, and this ends up going, I would say, somewhat poorly. The reflection that occurs there is that Joyce is still thinking about her boyfriend, Sean, who was in the prior season and who died. And so there's this uncomfortable bit there, and then Hopper sort of moves off and pretends that he wasn't really asking what he was asking. There's that uncomfortable element. I will say that with this show, I noticed that there were a lot of cuts. It felt a little bit more like an MTV kind of TV show that we would expect. There was a little bit less drawn out. But this ends up calming down until the last episode. But it ends up calming down in the second episode, third and fourth and fifth, and then ramps up a little bit later on. This is really just to introduce all these characters. It is a fairly big cast. We've added some characters. We've only subtracted a very few. We've actually just added some. And I think the Duffer Brothers did a pretty good job. This is something that, for example, you could say video games, role-playing games, both have the same exact problem. When you're building a video game, you're trying to put it together, you're trying to identify exactly what characters you want in a scene, and you end up having that group that's too big. A group that's that big, what it ends up doing is it neuters horror a lot of times. It neuters terror. It neuters the force of isolation, or the feeling of isolation, the feeling of dread if there's too many people. So you got to split them up, right? There's too much strength in numbers. And so a lot of shows, a lot of, you know, Dungeon Masters, if you're playing D&D, will split those groups up, or they will want to split up because it also looks a little funny when you have a goof troop of like 18 kids. This is something we've seen reflected from all the way back to Goonies, where they split up and there were two separate groups for a small amount of time before they met up underneath the restaurant. So this is something that's not necessarily unknown, but we do see it, that there's a little bit of forced keeping them apart that occurs here. It's not a bad thing at all. I think it works fairly well, but it is noticeable. Now it jumps to where the kids are together, and Dustin's walking up the hill. Mikey and Eleven, they bail. And this is, I think, the first moment when you get an idea that there's actual stress on everybody else's friendship, because they bail and they lie. This is something also that comes up a little bit later with Mikey in particular, where his honesty is put into question. And he is a fairly dishonest teen. If you look at everything he does, he is sort of the whiny, snivelly teen. He is a jackass to Hopper, and you know, Hopper, you get the idea. Hopper's going to put him under his blazer and drive over him. He is this snappy, the sarcastic teen. He does get put in his place pretty quickly, But this is something that when they're walking up the hill, Eleven and Mikey look at their watches. They've walked halfway up. This is where you get an indicator that there's a real issue. They walk halfway up the hill, right? It's like swimming halfway to a pier and then turning around and saying it's too far when you're already halfway there. This is something that you realize is brought on by them sort of wanting to pretend that they're involved with the group, but they're really not. So Eleven and Mikey basically say, hey, we're bailing, and they leave. And you get Lucas and a couple of the other kids sort of snapping off about this. And you get Dustin, who is not aware of the situation, finally getting a heads up on what's going on in this group and that dichotomy that's there. This is something that isn't as easily reflected in, let's say, video games or movies, because the goal or games, because the goal is usually known and it's not an exploratory feature like Stranger Things is. Stranger Things, especially when it starts, is really an exploratory journey of their youth in the first couple episodes as weird things start to happen. In most of the times in games, because you want that action right away, this occurs a little bit faster. In role-playing games, a lot of DMs, a lot of GMs will build a world and they'll let things slowly occur as well. But depending on what sense of history you have, you can't do that. So in Stranger Things, there's a lot of history. In Stranger Things, they have two seasons of history. So they can show this in a slow way, which is exactly what they do. And it works out quite well. And you get the idea of Mikey and Eleven bailing. You get the idea of the friendship being not in jeopardy, but certainly in question when it comes to who takes what seriously. And then you also get Dustin just now finding out what's going on. Importantly, so once again, you also get Will getting the feeling of the creature again, or of the Upside Down. Now, this, again, bothers me because he's with the group. Eleven and Mikey are running down. They're leaving the group. The rest of the kids are heading up, and Mikey feels that twinge in his neck again, his ESP, right? His creature ESP. This is something that we see in games. You get that knowing look from a character. And I think we're past that trope now. There's millions of ways to handle it. For example, I think it would have been very cool if perhaps Will told everybody. I said Mikey, I think, but Will feels this feeling. But Will, if Will told the group, and then the group maybe just shuns it off, just says, oh, you know, it's probably something else, and Dustin makes a joke about, oh, it's probably interference from the ham radio batteries I brought or something, you know what I mean? But instead, what happens is Will gets this feeling, and it flashes down to the rats. These rats we saw for a bit at the Steelworks, but the rats are were sort of going towards the sound when the creature, whatever, was awoken or came up out of the ground, and we see the rats in the grass in front of him. Strangely enough, we notice Will can't see them. This is not really explained. I couldn't quite figure it out, but again, he sees or he feels that creature, and he doesn't do anything. But what it does do is it does a very good cut, and it moves into the Steelworks, and it shows rats exploding and their innards creating something near where this creature or this shadow came out of the ground. I really like this. This is where we get a reflection of a lot of movies, in particular The Blob, with many things becoming one thing, and this nebulous force that is a little bit less, I would say, a little bit less individual than we saw in the prior seasons. The prior seasons, we would see an individual character. You'd see a character that you sort of knew what the bad guy was in the first one. You get the flower looking dude with, you know, I can't remember the dogs, whatever they're called, the demon dogs. You get this idea, or the Demogorgon, you get this idea of the exact character. You sort of know what they look like. What the Duffer Brothers did here was they changed it up with a power that no one understands. This is something that we see in sequels of a lot of video games. You get that first video game, you beat it. Maybe 2-3 years later, they decide they're going to do a sequel and they have to figure out, you know, what are we going to do? And they usually introduce the same bad guy, but with some kind of force that they have, something that is new, some new evil, but usually from the same characters or creatures. Now, a lot of times they'll break off as well, but if your first success was the original structure that you put together, a lot of times people will go back to it and sort of try to ice cream scoop something out of that, which is exactly what they did here. And you've got a definite reflection of the Blob. You also get a reflection of the Body Snatchers, which we will discuss in a little bit, in just a moment, in fact. But what you do is you get this idea of all of these creatures exploding, the sound effect causing them to rupture, and then they're forming into something. You start to see the first moments where the Blob starts to move. So then it pops back to Billy. Billy is watching Nancy's mom swimming in the pool. She gets up, and Billy comes down, and he strikes up a conversation. And I got to say, it really is a well done conversation, because Billy is shown from every single moment that he's ever shown to really have absolutely no morals. First of all, he knows for a fact Max and Nancy and all those are at least hanging together. All those kids are hanging together. He knows Nancy's married with kids, and he's trying to get up in that so hard it is actually uncomfortable. But he also knows that Nancy's mom likes him. So they have this conversation, and he is insanely sexual. I mean, it is redonkulous just how sleazy he is. They did such a great job. The actor does a fantastic job playing Billy. It is just really well done. It goes from the, hey, I noticed in the first moment where he notices her swimsuit, to here now she's swimming. And you can sort of get the idea, or you start to question, was Nancy's mom swimming simply to sort of show off in front of Billy? Because you do know that there's some chemistry there, or very least some sexual tension. So they end up talking together, and Billy just flat out basically says, there's a secret motel and a swimming pool, and I want to give you private lessons. He gives her a time. She hems and haws, says she doesn't need it, but you can tell she obviously likes him. He basically drops the hammer down and says, this is where it'll be. This is when it'll be, and I'll meet you there. And it's sort of a done deal with her never having to say she's for sure going, but she obviously is. It's very well done. It also shows just how brute force Billy is in almost everything. It's a good reflection of that. He is, I mean, really, when you look at Billy, he's infected everything. He infected the relationships when he first came in. He sort of injects himself into that family unit of Nancy's mom and dad and their kids and Nancy herself, and it continues on from here. So it's very well done. Billy does a spectacular job. And it also shows that this town is, once again, not just the kids. It's everybody doing their thing. And I think really what it ends up showing also is not only a reflection of the way Billy is, but the reflection of the way Nancy's mom is, what kind of strength she offers Nancy, if she offers her any strength, the issues she may be going through, and why it affects Nancy. So it's a very well done moment for a character that isn't a big deal in the major part of the story. It really works well. So there's various other bits that it cuts to with Joyce remembering Bob before he died. You also see this very cool picture that they drew of Bob as a superhero on the refrigerator. This is something that really solidifies the fact that Joyce hasn't moved on. And it has only been a couple months anyway since the elements that occurred in season two. So you get this cool moment where you realize this is what Joyce and her life is like. Also, though, it shows once again that Hopper isn't a very good detective at all, because he could have easily seen all of this, but he hasn't really figured it out. And the very cool stuff the Duffer Brothers did here, they took Joyce eating her dinner and then having flashbacks of eating with Bob, the actor Sean, his character from season two, and they intersperse them sort of seamlessly. So she's eating, then they're eating, then she's eating, and you get the idea that Bob's spirit's there. Bob's not going to leave, or at least hasn't left yet. But so that almost no scene is wasted, this is when you start to see that the magnets on her refrigerator demagnetize. This is explained later on why this may happen, but you see them pop off the wall, and this is all sort of timed up with experiments that are going on later. So you sort of see them come off the wall, and this is the first sort of moment where Joyce herself has something, at least back in her house, that is strange or supernatural. And she doesn't even notice right away, which is really cool. Now, at the exact same time, Nancy is still cleaning up. She's at the newspaper, and you get the idea that Nancy isn't only a glorified assistant or something like that. She's really the busy work person. She is, for all intents and purposes, the lowest bitch on the totem pole, you know, guy or girl, you know, how it used to be said. That's pretty much what it is. You're the lowest. It doesn't matter what skills you have. You're the one buying everybody food. You're the one cleaning up after everybody. You're the one that no one listens to. And it may take you years to get anywhere in that, in the industry, whatever that one may be. And for Nancy, it's wanting to be a newspaper reporter. So she's there late at night. She gets a phone call. And what I like about this moment is Nancy, throughout all of season three, really shows her chops here. She does a great job. She just walks over and picks up the phone. There isn't there isn't even an indication if she should be. It's past working hours, and she just walks over and picks up the investigator's line without a big amount of pause. It's just phone rings. She looks at it, phone rings. She's on her way, and she picks it up. And I like that about Nancy. She does end up stealing the show when it comes to Moxie and just putting things together and saying, you know what, I'm going to take things on. And I like that about the character. So she is informed of some strange rats at a person's house, and she sort of takes a note, and it moves on from there. Now, it does move on. This is when Mikey and Eleven are back in their house again, macking on each other. Hopper loses his mind. He tries to give the speech. It doesn't work out very well at all. And Mikey is a jackass. I am telling you right now, if I acted this way in that time period, like that, in front of a girlfriend's dad, that girlfriend's dad would most likely kick me through the door. He would shut it so he could kick me through the fucker because he would just want to prove a point. I don't know if I've ever seen a character that sort of snippy, especially when they're doing it to a parent who is the sheriff. So he gets snippy with Hopper, and Hopper decides, I'm not going to give the speech. So he takes him into the Blazer Bronco and says, I'm going to drive you home. You're not staying here. You're not going to hang out with my daughter tonight. And he basically lies to Mikey to get him in the room, says something's wrong with a family member. Mikey gets in. Mikey gets mad. And Hopper fucking unleashes on him. And you finally start to see Hopper's at the end of his collective rope. But additionally, you get to see that Mikey is just sort of a puffed up paper bag. Once Hopper basically puts it down, you realize Mikey is shitting himself. And it's really well done because there's no supernatural stuff that's going on at this point, right? Nothing at all. It's just Hopper and him in this car and Hopper laying it down. Nothing supernatural going on at all. And Mikey just absolutely getting ready to shart everywhere. So scared of Hopper, and Hopper drives him home. I love that. It was done so well. Once again, it separates that consistent feeling of the supernatural that can occur. This is something that we see in games a lot of times where you see, even in role-playing games, you'll have DMs who they'll forget that not everything has to be action. Not everything has to be about the main event. In fact, many times, let's say you're told you need to save a town or you need to go and do this, and you see all the people who are hurt, and you're like, yep, I got to save the town from the bad guys. But you find out later that it wasn't even one of those characters that you met in that town that makes you want to save the town. It's the dog that you walked up to that was scared. You gave it a bone and it ran off, right? It's that side. It's that momentary element that's on the side that isn't connected to that forcefulness that everything else is connected to, and in the force that's sort of driving everybody else forward. And I think that was done really well here. This is when I think the show starts to sort of get going. You start to see a lot of foreshadowing here. It ends up breaking off to Dustin and everybody at the top of the hill and talking for a little bit of time and putting together this giant ham radio antenna. Now the other kids decide to leave when he can't get it working right away. And there's a couple things that I thought was odd here. First, I don't know what town they lived in, but I certainly know when I was a kid, my parents would just be like, you know, don't come home until the streetlights are on, or come home when the streetlights are on. And they would sort of let you go. It was a safer time. It was a more innocent time. That's reflected by the fact that Dustin is on this friggin' hill all by himself and everybody leaves him. Everybody leaves him. He's on the hill all by himself overlooking town. We don't know how long it was, and we don't get we don't have any idea, you know, are they walking to their bikes and then biking into town? Are they walking to cars? Are they walking to a bus stop? We have no clue, but Mikey's just up there by himself and he can't get his radio receiver to pick up anything until he ends up getting a strange code that he can't understand. He ends up picking it up when he's up there, and it sounds like it's in Russian. So that's sort of another indicator once again of not only the time frame this was done, a more innocent time, I think, than we all sort of understand, but additionally, a time where you see Dustin is separated from the rest of the group. He's extended himself in a different way than everybody else. He's lived a different life than everybody else for those months he was gone, and he's returned. And, you know, when absence is fresh, it matters and you notice it more. But the absence of Dustin, he's been gone. He's been gone long enough that life has sort of continued a little bit without him. And it doesn't mean he can't inject himself back into it, but there's a little bit of an uncomfortableness there. And it's reflected really well here with them just leaving him and him not doing what I think a lot of people expected him to do when I saw this scene. I expected him to be like, okay, I'll go with you. He doesn't. He stays up there by himself, which I think is an indicator also that he's a little stronger than he was. And he was always pretty headstrong, which I really liked about this character. But he stays up there by himself. He hears this Russian signal. He doesn't go running down after everybody. Instead, he listens to it. Very cool. And again, episode one, lots of cuts, a lot of different stuff. So I think this is expected. We're almost done with episode one. So the next thing it pops over to is Karen Wheeler. She's getting dressed up. She's going to go fuck Billy, right? She's going to go swimming for a private lesson. And it cuts to her getting all dolled up for back in that time period. Makeup on, dressed to the hilt. She comes downstairs and you see her husband and Nancy's little brother, her son, laying with her husband. And what you get is that dichotomy of what's going on inside of Karen. And I think it's done really well. Nancy's mom may have problems in so many different places, but she's not careless and she's certainly not emotionless. She sees her husband, who maybe they're not, you know, getting it on as freaky as she'd want or as often as she'd want, but he's sitting there with her kid and daughter. I apologize. She sees them sleeping and she says, you know what? I can't, there's no way I can, you know, I can go and end up sleeping with Billy. So she decides she's not going to leave. She chickens out. And then it cuts to Billy. Billy is not paying attention. Something causes him to wreck right near the steelwork, something that's involved with something that's, I couldn't really tell exactly what it was, but it causes him to wreck right outside the steelworks. And of course he's driving, you know, Camaro, Mustang, that kind of thing. A Camaro or a Firebird of some kind. He ends up wrecking and can't start the car. So he gets out and ends up hearing this sound and ends up going inside of the steelwork. And he's pulled in by something. That, again, I think shows the strength of episodic, where they just cut off and they're like, you know, that's the end of episode one. And you've seen a great number of characters. You've seen some side characters, too, with some nice, well-placed cuts. They've been able to not only introduce a lot of these characters, but introduce the angst. Everybody's going through the changes, sort of the parallel lines of change that have occurred, where they split at the starting of summer. And that entire time, everybody moved forward and then they're coming back together. And how all of that sort of worked, but also the parallel lines of what's happened in the town versus what happened, at least in the starting, when we see that momentary element of the Russians and how they're going about things. And it's very well done. It's well done because there's multiple different mysteries that you have here. And I've always believed that in video games, this also works well. It's one of the reasons why I think Halo works so well. Halo has the Covenant. And they're the primary force of, I think, the primary structure when it comes to a foe. They're a religious foe bent on religious destruction. The humans know that much, right? They really consider the humans a stain on everything. And you get that idea. And this is Halo 1 we're talking about. And the humans have, I think, identified maybe not the way to fight them, but they know that the Spartan Project can do it, or at least behind the scenes, those people know that. And as you're playing it, you get this idea it's continually the Covenant up until the point that the Flood are introduced and you have no clue what's going on. You're not even told there's Flood. You start the game. There's no indications of Flood. There's no precursors of it. There's no hints of it. There's no nothing. There's no foreshadowing of it. You just start to pick up on the fact that the Covenant are there for a reason, but you're under the assumption the Covenant are there for a weapon in the way that the military in Halo thinks of weapons, which is a bigger gun, right? That's exactly what they think of, a bigger weapon. But then you get the idea that they're scared and you don't really pick up on a lot of stuff because there isn't a lot to pick up on. And boom, the Flood are introduced. And that's sort of what I like here is every single season they've tried to introduce something. The first season they didn't have to introduce that many things. But in a third season, you have so many different elements that are occurring, so many histories that are occurring that you can crib off of, but also that you have to worry about. Every strength is a weakness when it comes to game making, when it comes to creation of a story when you're a dungeon master, when it comes to a creation of a story when you're a novelist, if you continue to move on. This is something that, Game of Thrones has definitely had an issue with in the novel form as well as TV show, where you have this continually a developed history, and then everybody expects that history to be reflected perfectly as we move forward. What I like here is the introduction of a new bad guy, but also the introduction of a different style. This is something that, like I talked about at the starting, you have the Blob, and I would say really Invasion of the Body Snatchers being the major two that occur here. Maybe a little, some elements of John Carpenter's The Thing, but you have more of the Blob and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where we start to see these things created that have a different feel than season one and two. And I think that's really well done. It causes you to question now, once again, what exactly is going on. This is certainly reflected in episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 and all that. It's just really well done. It makes it feel different. It makes it feel alive. It makes it a place where you question exactly what's occurring. And again, in some of the best games we've played, they do the same thing. Whether it be an Uncharted with the mystical mixed with the normal, whether Tomb Raider, same way, whether it be a Halo where you have the Flood and the Covenant. The strength, I think, is when they can play those off of each other. And right away, we notice that in Stranger Things episode one. So I was looking at the time here. We're already at 1 hour, and that's longer than the episode itself is. And I apologize for that, but there's a lot to talk about, especially when you look at how games are created. Depending on how they are, whether it be sequels 1, 2, 3, and 4, whether it be just one big epic blockbuster, whether it be a TV show, a movie, a novel, all of these things, how they're created. And I think looking at Stranger Things, this is such a great point because we have so many movies that are, you know, Lord of the Rings, those kind of things that can be translated into games. But a lot of times there's a dearth of material depending on the IP, depending on what can be used, that kind of stuff. And then you have episodic games, and everything can be sort of offered in a unique way and in a different feel. And I think that what Stranger Things, these seasons in particular, show is that this kind of entertainment is actually really enjoyed by gamers. Now, whether you would do a, let's say, some kind of last time on Alan Wake, which I think is why Alan Wake worked so well, because it pretended there were episodes and there weren't. Or you do true episodic. I think the biggest issue with episodic, of course, is your business standpoint, where you get something like Blues and Bullets, where you only get episodes 1 and 2. You never get 3 because it's you know, the company's gone out of business. As with Telltale, we were worried, or those of you who played it were worried, that Walking Dead wouldn't be finished. So when it comes to games, when it comes to all this stuff, I think there's a lot of mimicry. I think there's a lot of cribbing, and I think there's a lot to be learned from the different people who are enjoying these kinds of entertainment, and really should be shared, really should be something that you as a gamer or you as a TV show watcher, when you look at these kind of things, you should expect in your games, and you should be able to identify, you know, the next time you're playing a good story in a game, be able to go, I see what they did there. And hopefully we get some adjustments. We get some tropes being adjusted. I think with Stranger Things, that's why it worked. I think Tarantino's done that with a couple movies where it turns it on its head. Scream, I think the Scream movies, at least the first one or two, turned things on their head. And what happens is it injects a freshness into everything. And even when that freshness is a freshness from 1980s, which is what Stranger Things does, if it does it right, it can work so well. And it's a fruitful endeavor, I think, for game makers, for game players to watch these kind of shows and understand how they can be done and understand the difference between something that's force-fed to you over 8 hours versus something that, let's say, has a longer time to sort of be created and be thrown out. It's interesting to me that Stranger Things has so many things going on, but it is technically, if you take all the episodes, only about 8 hours. It's actually a little less. And I like that. I think it's cool. I think it shows that, of course, it's non-interactive, so it will go by shorter, but what can be done in that time frame, and what personally I would like to see more game makers do, which is take a step back and not be so fucking triple X about making your games, which is like, you know, foot all the way down, or like Fast and Furious, you know, I live my life 1 mile at a time, you know, or whatever the fuck that dude mumbles. That's the way a lot of games are presented, and I think that there's a course correction that can be had for some games. Not every game needs to do this, of course, because games are different, but I would like to see some games take a little bit more of a slower pace. And I've certainly noticed myself, if they do that, but they still offer you questions and thought processes, different things to look at and different interesting characters, you can get some really amazing times. You can do it with gameplay adjustments and additions. You can do it with story and narrative like we see with this show. But I think there's a lot of mimicry, a lot of reflection there, that anybody who likes games or TV shows or movies you can sort of see regardless. So I think I'll cut this and just say this will be the episode. I'll probably just post this on Anchor, which is the audio. So you'll hear me on the audio websites. If you like this, I would love for you to, you know, tweet it that you that you listened to it and you liked it. If you want me to cover more stuff in episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, what have you, feel free to say so. I'm sure I made a couple mistakes here. Might have made a couple on the edits or on the which cuts happened when. I apologize. That's just the name of the game when you have this many cuts in a TV show in that first episode. I watched it twice just to parse it, and I probably still messed up once or twice. So ignoring that, you don't need to tell me. I know I messed up. But if you do want me to talk about more stuff when it comes to game development, when you want to talk, you want to ask me any questions, you want me to cover particular things in the other episodes, I absolutely can. Just make sure to tweet me and tell me that you want those things done. I'll try to add them. I can't say I'll add them all. Anyway, that's it for me. I want to say thanks to everybody who stuck around and listened to this entire thing. I think it's a very cool show. Regardless if you like the show or not, I think it's also very cool because there's so many similarities between shows and games that we can see some of the strengths that are done here that I would love to see in more games that we don't. If you get a chance, check out the Patreon. There's nothing going on YouTube. Everything's demonetized. I would absolutely love some help on Patreon. If you get a chance, jump on by. I can absolutely tell you it's the best community that there exists on the net. It's insane. It's so cool. I would love for you to be a part of it. Make sure you follow me on Anchor, iTunes as well, or Spotify, or wherever you listen to this. I would love for you to do that. Anyway, that's it for me. Peace out. See you on episode 2.